Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In late June, a massive wildfire spread across the Yarnell Hills near Prescott, Arizona, burning 8,400 acres and claiming the lives of 19 members of an elite firefighting crew called the Hotshots. According to the Valley Fever newspaper in Phoenix, the epic scale of the tragedy cannot be understated. It's the eighth worst fire in U.S. history. The last time so many firefighters lost their lives in a single day was on 9/11. This tragedy raised many concerns for those of us living in western states where conditions are dry and getting drier with climate change. And we have reason to be concerned. Wildfire statistics compiled by the National Interagency Fire Center in Boise, Idaho, offer some sobering stats. The seven largest fire years since 1960 have all occurred since 2000. In 2006, 2007, and last year, the toll exceeded 9 million acres, an area roughly equivalent to Maryland and Rhode Island combined. In congressional testimony 2 years ago, Thomas Tidwell, head of the U.S. Forest Service, told lawmakers that his agency faces conditions of higher temperatures, earlier mountain snowmelt, and much longer fire seasons, which, quote, our scientists believe is due to a change in climate, end quote. So how can we manage our forests and wildlands to prevent fires from becoming uncontrollable and devastating? Or is it inevitable, given the climate we're now dealing with? And what about politics? How does that affect fire management? Today, we're joined by Dr. Scott Stevens. He's a professor of fire science in the Department of Environmental Science, Policy, and Management at UC Berkeley. He's also director of the UC Center for Fire Research and Outreach and co-director of the UC Center for Forestry. Hi, Scott. Welcome to the show.
Hello.
Nice to have you. We're also joined by Rich Fairbanks. He's worked in forestry for 41 years, serving in many positions, including interagency hotshot crew foreman, division supervisor, and complex burn boss. Rich currently owns Fairbanks Forest Management, a company that helps property owners address these problems. And he now joins us from his home in the Applegate Valley of Southern Oregon. Hi, Rich. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Rich, what is a complex burn boss?
Oh, it's somebody who is supervises a controlled burn, and obviously a controlled burn of a fair amount of complexity.
Well, so you're up in Oregon, and I understand that you actually have some fire issues right around your home.
Well, it's 20-30 miles north of here. Unfortunately, we have a northwest wind for the last 4 days. So yes, we're nowhere near the fire, but we're getting a lot of smoke. They're saying it's unhealthy. I'm looking out my window, and I'd say the visibility is maybe a quarter mile.
You know, in so many of the articles that we've been reading, a lot of scientists, a lot of people who've got a lot of experience with fire say this is the new norm, get used to it. Can you elaborate on that? What does that mean exactly?
Well, there's a really good paper out, Anthony Westerling and some other authors, UC California and La Jolla Scripps Institute put out a paper a few years ago, where they looked at records that we've been keeping since 1910, and the Forest Service, the government, and they're pretty careful records. And what they were able to determine, these researchers, was that the length of fires from discovery to control was getting longer, had gotten longer, and the number of acres has grown. So on average, over the long term, 1910, that's a lot of data, you know, 100 years of data, things are getting hotter.
Well, and also, according to these stats by the National Interagency Fire Center in Boise, Idaho, the seven largest fires since 1960 have all occurred since 2000?
Yes, yes. It seems to be accelerating. It's hard to tell. Again, I go back to these longer data sets, where you can really see what's going on, and again, 100 years of data. It's pretty convincing. And that was a very careful study. I read it pretty carefully, and it's real. It's real. For whatever reason, it's getting hotter.
Scott, what are your thoughts on this? How should we make sense of this data?
Well, I think it's absolutely true that the recent fire area is going up, just like you alluded to, and certainly we're getting some of the biggest fires in states in the western U.S. in the last 10 years or so. One thing that's a little interesting is we did a paper in 2007 trying to estimate how much area used to burn in just the state of California, the lands of the state of California, say pre-1800, based on just lightning fire and also Native American or Indian ignitions. And we estimated for California alone it was 4.5 million acres.
Wow.
So it really was an amazing amount of fire, at least in this state. I don't know of other works in other states like Oregon. But when you think about California as a golden state, I actually call it the Pyro State.
Wow, the Pyro State.
Yeah, it used to have fire as such an integral piece of the ecosystem. And there's no doubt fires are getting larger, they're causing damage, and some of them are really devastating. But if we put our lens on and look back, boy, fire used to be a bigger piece of the environment.
If for those of us who live in Northern California, where are some of the hot spots? What areas do you watch closely?
Oh, I think it's really, for me, nowadays, it's really when you talk about fire and people. You know, where people live in the urban interface, that's the place that gets so much attention now, rightly so, because of things like hazards in life and structures. But as we move more and more people in those areas, it's almost like we're jamming so many people in wildlands that we're all running to kind of look at the urban interface. And unfortunately, I think the wildlands are maybe taking a little bit of a second seat.
And so, Rich, what really explains this? It was interesting to read congressional testimony 2 years ago by Thomas Tidwell, head of the U.S. Forest Service. And he said his agency faces higher temperatures, earlier mountain snowmelt, longer fire seasons, which their scientists believe is due to a change in climate. How do you explain what we're facing right now?
Well, I agree. It is a change in climate, and it's also very much what Scott alluded to. Nature used to burn, here in Southern Oregon, same situation. Nature used to burn often, and in the mixed conifer, which you folks have 6 million acres of mixed conifer, that's the kind of forest that grows around Yosemite, for example. Those places burned, on the average, less than every 10 years. It's remarkable how frequently they burned. But as John Muir and other early explorers described, it was this very low severity, low intensity fire that crept along and reduced fuels without killing most of the trees. And this is very important. As Scott alluded to, California used to burn about 4 million acres a year out of a 100 million acre state. Your state is very conveniently almost exactly 100 million acres. So obviously, it used to, even the worst fire season, 2008, they burned about 800,000 acres in Northern California. So even the really bad fire seasons were not back to that pre-European settlement norm, where fire used to be just a regular visitor to many forest types. And so obviously if you keep fire out and fuels begin to increase, you're creating a big problem, and that's what Westerling was seeing. The combination of warmer, drier weather with putting out all the fires historically for the last 60 years, basically, has created kind of a perfect storm. Then you throw in all these subdivisions, wood frame house subdivisions, and what could possibly go wrong?
Is that why they're bigger and more destructive?
Scott, go for it.
Well, I agree with what Rich said totally. I mean, if you take the fire out of the system, we have our natural forest succession and just natural ecology. These systems are changing. They're getting higher fuel loads, more continuity of fuels, both vertically to move fire up and also horizontally to move fire along. And then throw in on top of that, we have warming climates and actually more variation in climate. In some ways it is. It's a setup for real, real problems, at least in the forest that used to burn frequently every 25 years or so. If you looked at forests that used to burn every 100 to 200 years, like the Rocky Mountains, some of them, then maybe we have a different conversation. But I agree with Rich totally. You really set up a kind of a perfect storm.
Well, and Scott, I mean, you focus on the interaction between wildland fires and ecosystems. And there are plenty of ecosystems, plants and trees, that depend on fires to survive and thrive. So how has that interaction changed over the last few decades?
Well, this is a good question. If you talk about like the mixed conifer forest that Rich alluded to up there, here we're starting to see patch sizes of mortality getting very large. And this makes us very concerned because mixed conifer forest doesn't really have an ability to store its seed after a high severity or high intensity fire. So the seeds essentially are burned up along with the trees and the shrubs. So if you get patches of 400 acres, 300 acres, 100 acres, 1,000 acres, where you have trees essentially removed because of really high severity fire, those forests really have no means to regenerate unless you're going to plant them artificially with seedlings. So this idea of how fire is changing, and the area is certainly going up, but also kind of the scale of the mortality is also going up in a lot of areas. That causes great concern from an ecological perspective.
And Rich, what would you add to that?
Well, it's just absolutely true. And when we look at fire ecology, and we're getting more sophisticated every year, we're getting new information, we're finding that fire, like other processes, is very nuanced. So in Southern California, you can't apply the rules that you try to apply in the Sierra, and you can't even apply the rules that you learn in Southern Oregon necessarily to the forests of the Sierra. So every mountainside is a little different in its response to fire. There's some overall things we can say to characterize fire behavior and how it's changing and how it's interacting with cities, basically.
And Rich, how do most of these wildfires actually start?
Well, lightning is the biggest one. Equipment use is still a big one. That's about, I believe, 29% of fires in California are equipment use. A lot of that is logging equipment. But lightning's definitely the champion for starting fires. All of these fires we got up here, now we've got several thousand acres on fire here in Southern Oregon, and they were all from one lightning storm.
And then how do they spread? So if the lightning hits, what happens after that?
Okay, if the lightning hits and it's dry enough so that the fuels on the forest floor will burn, then the fire will start creeping around that lightning strike. I've done this many times. And it'll begin to gain momentum if the fuels are dry and the wind's blowing. And fairly quickly, in conditions like we've got now, it'll start torching. It'll start climbing trees and blasting them out, you know, like you see movies of a Christmas tree burning in those fire prevention messages. Imagine that with a 100-foot-tall tree. That starts happening. If that happens, what they call torching, on a large scale, eventually what you get is a crown fire, and that means the fire has completely moved up into the crowns of the trees. And up here, that means 150-foot-tall trees. And you get a really impressive head of steam on a fire like that, a running crown fire, and there's nothing you can do. The crews can flank it. They can work the edges, but they can't really get anywhere near that crowning head of the fire.
What do we need to know about what goes on behind the scenes? How does the crew determine the best action to take?
Well, there's all kinds of, you can take a whole course in tactics, fire line tactics. I teach crew boss and engine boss in the spring, and we spend several hours on how to safely approach and attack a fire. Basically, you find an anchor point somewhere at the back of the fire, away from the wind, away from what's making it move. And you flank around, and gradually you build a line around it. And what I mean by a line is you want to starve the fire of fuel. It's not like a house fire where you pump water on it. That doesn't really work very well for forest fires for a number of reasons. What you do is you build a fire line that's down to mineral soil a few inches wide, like a recreation trail, and then clear to brush 10, 15, 20 feet, depending on the fire, sometimes much more. And any large dead trees, unfortunately, have to be cut, too. So you create a path through the forest. And that in itself can, unfortunately, have a lot of consequences, erosion and so forth. So the suppression itself is a two-edged sword. You fight the fire, but you try to do it in a way that doesn't trash the resource at the same time.
That is Rich Fairbanks. He's worked in forestry for 41 years, serving in many positions, including interagency hotshot crew foreman. And you might remember that in late June, there was a massive wildfire in Prescott, Arizona, burning 8,400 acres and claiming the lives of 19 members of this elite firefighting crew called the Hotshots. NPR did a really interesting piece about these men and women. In this case, they were all men who died, but there are women who are also hot shots, and they spend about 6 months out of the year traveling around the country to find these hot spots to try to prevent and fight these fires. We're also joined by Dr. Scott Stevens, assistant professor of fire sciences at professor of fire science in the Department of Environmental Science, Policy and Management at UC Berkeley. And today we are talking about wildfires. Scientists and people who work in this field say this is the new norm. The seven largest fires since 1960 have all occurred since the year 2000. And Thomas Tidwell, the head of the U.S. Forest Service, say our scientists believe this is due to a change in climate. So if you live near a fire-prone area, we'd love to hear from you. What role is the government taking? What role do you think the government should take? What prevention methods do you think we need to use? And what do you do in your home or yard to be fire safe? And if you have any questions for Rich and Scott about this issue, a lot of us who live in cities, we hear about the fires, we might smell some smoke, but do we really know what really goes on behind the scenes, how the fires spread, how fire departments respond, and then how budget cuts have affected all of this? We'll also talk about that. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a message, a question on our website, yourcallradio.org. Let's go to David in San Francisco. Hi, David.
Yeah, morning, Rose and your guest. You know, I remember probably 10 or maybe even longer years ago, the fire service started cutting out all of the brush underneath the forests of the nation. And it would seem to me that that would actually dry things out worse. If I remember right, there was somewhat of a scam tied to it in that the logging industry wanted to go in there and reclaim the fallen trees. And they were essentially going to just harvest everything. But it would seem to me that by cutting out all of the brush, that creates much more wind down in the forest floors and then causes things to dry out. There's also a second angle. Every time they lay a road, they lay in gutters. And so whenever you put in gutters, that forces the water that would fall in a normal rainfall to get drained down. And so it doesn't stay on the land. So those two angles.
Interesting. Yeah. Thank you for calling in, David. What are your thoughts on that, Scott? First off, what about cutting brush? How does that affect these fires?
Well, that's a great question because you would think, as you said, that if you open up the forest a little bit, maybe you have higher wind velocities, maybe you get more sunlight in, you could potentially have higher temperatures and maybe lower humidities. Actually, a study here in California looked at that pretty carefully. A guy named Malcolm North and Seth Bigelow, they actually monitored those very variables in areas that have been harvested kind of with a thinning operation to reduce forest canopy and remove brush and small trees versus areas that were intact. And since we had such a long, hot summer here in California that we don't really get any rain at all, Southern Oregon, I believe, is similar, that the research showed that those fuels and temperatures got to a point where essentially it didn't really matter if we took out some of those latter fuels and shrubs. Essentially, all the fuels and all the area had similar weather and kind of fuel properties, which is interesting. And the other one about roads is an interesting one, too, because, yes, roads do cause erosion. We know that from the past, but we also know the Forest Service and others do a lot better job making roads today, so they're actually less problematic. But I don't think that, in my view, you don't need to build roads into roadless areas to try to figure out a way to maybe do fire management. There are other ways you could do it, too. But I think that most evidence shows that you can do reduction in fuels and actually not cause any ecological harm. If anything, maybe a positive side.
So, Rich, what is the best way to go about doing that?
Well, this caller's right. There are people who have said that, oh, thinning is the way to prevent fires, and there is a role for that. It's been sort of exaggerated by the timber industry for obvious reasons, but thinning really does work, especially around communities. Taking out smaller understory trees can be, especially if it's followed up with by aggressive slash treatment, aggressively treating the fuels that you create, the tops and the limbs and so forth, thinning can be very effective. And one of the nice things about thinning is, again, removing understory trees and brush, is if it's done right, it really emulates what the low surface fires that we've been talking about used to do. So you're kind of imitating nature if you do it right with the thinning.
And what else would you add in terms of prevention methods? Rich, what's at the top of your list?
The top of my list is modernizing building codes. And I know building codes and zoning are the two most boring subjects in the world, so I won't dwell. But building codes for houses that are built out in the wildlands should be based on sound science. And right now we're building wood frame subdivisions out into places where there's wind corridors, where there's places where the wind blows a lot during fire season, blows hot and dry. We're building on steep slopes where fire burns much more intensely and is much more difficult to control. We're doing a lot of building in the wrong place. That's a zoning issue. And we, again, we can use science to tell us where it's hazardous to build the normal way. And we can kind of put public safety ahead of various other interests and do science-based zoning and building codes. That would help in the long run. In the short run...
And on that, just quickly, yeah, is that on the radar of the people who make these building decisions?
Somewhat. And California is leading the way, once again. There's a building code now for Los Angeles County that's very good, that recognizes a lot of the science that's taken place. So right there at UC Berkeley, a lot of this research was done on how to make a roof so it doesn't burn through, things like that. And just real simple things like you putting thermal pane windows in your house can tremendously up the chances that it will survive a fire. So these things are very effective, and most of them are real cheap, too. They're just people need to change, you know, the way they do things. If building code worked fine in New Jersey, then it should work fine here. Well, that's not true. We found out that houses really catch fire very easily in these wildfires because of some simple things that weren't done.
And then you had another suggestion?
Well, yeah. I talked about zoning. That's, again, building in a chaparral brush field, building a wood frame house in a chaparral brush field, building 1,000 of them is kind of how they do it a lot of times. You know, they're basically suicide subdivisions. They're just asking for problems, and we need to change the way we do that. And then the next thing I was going to talk about was, fuel treatment and stuff. So, but zoning and building codes, really important.
And, Scott, what's at the top of your list for prevention?
I have to agree with Rich about the zoning and building codes. I think the way we build in our wildlands is something that just fundamentally is illogical. We've done terrible jobs in the past. We are doing better, you know, in some areas, but when you think about just additionally putting more and more assets at risk, and also when managers like Rich and others try to manage fire and you have all these assets at risk, immediately they become the priority. They also become a challenge to work around if you're trying to do fuels treatments and prescribed burning. So it's like this double-edged sword. You're putting in more assets at risk and more people at risk, and you're also reducing management options. In some ways, we've got to change that trajectory. And I think most of it's local county control, you know, land use planning and stuff in the counties. And then suppression costs come in, and suppression costs are inflammatory and huge. I've always wondered if whether or not there might be a time when we start to share those suppression costs with counties and states to try to get them maybe to think more about land use planning, because right now I think the federal government and FEMA pick up most of the costs, so in some ways are a little off the hook.
Well, that was my next question, is when you look at local, state, and federal governments, who makes the decisions here?
I think most of this is local, at least in California. I've talked to California's got 58 counties, and each of the counties really does have a domain of land use planning, with certainly supervision from the state, from some ordinances and laws. But it really is a local decision primarily. There are things, like Rich alluded to, the L.A. counties, and there's even some codes that actually are statewide now, but there are still a lot to do there. It really is a county decision. It is a local decision, what I understand.
Excuse me. The same thing is true in Oregon. The county commissioners, you guys, I believe it's county supervisors, have all kinds of power to do zoning, building codes, to regulate building in the county.
And that's Rich Fairbanks. He's worked in forestry for 41 years. Dr. Scott Stevens is professor of fire sciences at UC Berkeley. Today, we are talking about wildfires. Scientists and people who work in this field say these massive wildfires are now the new norm. And so we're talking today about the best ways to prevent them actually before they happen. After the break, we'll talk about the politics behind this and how that affects when these fires actually are, or how these fires are actually dealt with. And we'd love to hear from you. It's your call. We'll be back after this.
Lots of ways to join in the conversation on Your Call, on the phone, via email, or leave a message on the website at yourcallradio.org. The number to call is 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK, or you can send an email question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org, or simply leave a message at yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We'll be talking about media coverage of the Bradley Manning trial. How are reporters covering what the documents he leaked actually contain? He says he leaked them to start a debate about U.S. foreign policy. So did that happen in the media? And what are the consequences of this case for the future of journalism and whistleblowers? And then on Monday, we'll have a conversation with Gary Young. He is a columnist with The Guardian based in Chicago. He's out with a new book about Martin Luther King's famous speech, I Have a Dream. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about these massive wildfires that we've seen over the last decade. The seven largest fires since 1960 have all occurred since the year 2000. And scientists and people who work in this field say this is the new norm. So what is the best way to actually prevent these fires? What's happening in your area, especially if you live in a fire-prone area, if you are or have been a firefighter, a scientist, if you work in this field, we'd love to hear from you. What role should your government take on this issue? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Rich Fairbanks. He's worked in forestry for 41 years, serving in many positions, including interagency hotshot crew foreman. Rich currently owns Fairbanks Forest Management, a company that helps property owners address fire problems. And he's joining us from Southern Oregon. We're also joined by Dr. Scott Stevens, professor of fire science at UC Berkeley. He also directs the UC Center for Fire Research and Outreach and co-directs the UC Center for Forestry. And we have an email from Lisa in Carmel. Actually, she called and couldn't stay on the phone. She says that government should really focus on global warming and that will improve the health of trees. What do you think about that, Rich?
Yeah, that's a great idea. We know that increasing temperatures are putting stress on forest trees, and unfortunately, especially some of the older, the big magnificent pines that you see in Yosemite and stuff like that, they're really having difficulty dealing with this this increase in temperature. So, yeah, I completely agree.
Scott, anything to add there?
No, I would agree, too. I think that the climate change is going to affect all of us. You know, the forest has an incredible inertia, so we can, I think, still do some things today proactively, the fuel treatments we talked about and other things that could really make them more resilient to the future. So there are options that we could do today, but I absolutely agree that, you know, that's a big issue.
You know, and when we talk about climate change, I mean, it's such a huge topic, but what could the government actually do to address this issue?
Well, okay, let me jump in. One of the things that you can do is we've got a tremendous amount of what they call second growth, places that have been cut already, and the trees are growing back. And those trees are growing back at often 500, 600, 700 trees per acre. If you thin and remove half of those trees, the remaining trees are half as thirsty, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot you can do to reduce the stress on forests. Yeah, thinning is just one example of one of the things you can do. One of the most important things we can do to relieve some of the stress on these forests, believe it or not, is to put fire back in the forest. A low-severity ground fire will do the same. It'll do the thinning effect that I was talking about earlier, where it'll kill some of the weaker trees, some of the smaller trees, and therefore there will be enough water left for the remaining trees so that they can thrive. They can resist attacks by bark beetles. It's just, I hate to use the term, but it's a healthy forest. And that's one of the reasons why it's so critical that the public understand when we're trying to do this low severity, this underburning in the conifer forests, that people be tolerant of smoke and delays on the road and so forth, because it is basically a pretty large-scale operation that involves inconvenience for people. But the controlled burning is really, really important for the health of the forest.
Yeah, you know, I'm glad you mentioned that. I mean, what else do you think we need to know about this issue? Because it's not something we talk about much in this country until we get a massive wildfire. And then in the case of what happened in Prescott, Arizona, it's so devastating that, you know, 19 firefighters died. And yet we really didn't have, at least I didn't hear, a back conversation about a lot of these issues. So what else do we need to know, Rich?
Well, one thing you need to know is that there's constant pressure to do that controlled burning on the cheap, and that is a bad idea. That is why fires escape to a large extent.
And what does that mean to do it on the cheap?
I mean, when you do controlled burning, you need to do it with the contingency forces. You need to do it with an extra crew there standing by. You need to do it with the right amount of hose and pumps and the things that you need.
Huh.
And trying to do that on the cheap, trying to do it very inexpensively, is a mistake. And we've learned that over and over again. I'm sure you've read about escaped control burns, burning up somebody's barn or something. It's something we have to invest in. And, this whole smaller government idea works great until you have a big problem that government really can solve. And then if you don't spend the money, you aren't going to get the result you want.
Well, so how are budget cuts that we're seeing across the country, how are they affecting this issue and fire departments?
Well, availability for suppression. Basically, the standard unit for firefighting is a 20-person crew. That for wild firefighting, that's a lot of the work gets done by these 20-person crews. The availability, 15 years ago in the 90s, there were about 800 20-person crews available nationwide. During fire season, you could call up theoretically and order 800 crews, and you'd get them. Obviously, today there are about 425 crews.
Wow, so almost half.
Yeah. And so, I'll give you some more numbers to give you an idea of the magnitude of the problem. Okay, those suppression crews that you cut in half, remember, they work for a month or so on either side of fire season doing fuel treatment work. So they're vital because they morph back into brush disposal crews in the fall and the winter. And hopefully a lot of them do work fairly long seasons. That's been a problem in the past. But look at the magnitude of the problem. California is about 100 million, again, conveniently almost exactly 100 million acres. I think about half of that is forest and brush and wildlands of various kinds. But we've treated fuel treatment in say, the year 2010, that's the last one I have information for, treated 244,000 acres, so about 250,000 acres. So that's a quarter of 1%. Yeah, quarter of 1%. Boy, doing math on the radio is hard.
You're doing good.
But anyway, you see my point.
Yeah.
We're trying to bail out a swimming pool with a teaspoon. And so we need to ramp up. The treatments we're doing are effective. They work, whether it's mechanical or, with a chainsaw or doing it by burning or whatever. These treatments work. The science, thank you, Scott, is solid. We can go forward. The practitioners know that what we're doing works. The problem is the scale.
Scott, what would you add to that in terms of how budget cuts have affected what fire departments can or cannot do?
Well, I would really agree with what Rich says about our progression. And one way that is interesting to me is, you always hear about the fires that go awry. And the first time I actually was able to testify for Congress was Los Alamos fire in 2000, and that was one of the prescribed fires that Rich alluded to that got away and caused some real damage. But we don't get to hear about the successes. Mm-hmm. We don't get to hear about the fire crews that are doing great work and making big differences at, say, local scales. And Rich is absolutely right in terms of the need to scale up. It really is probably the issue in terms of kind of trying to change the trajectory of fire and forest. But we also have a lot of successes. I'm sure Rich could tell you a lot of successes of him and his colleagues that in their careers, what they've done. But we only get to hear about the ones that go awry. And I think it further makes it difficult for public some things to think there's some hope. It seems like a lot of folks think that there's no hope, you can't do anything. But you can. You can do that fuels treatment, increase it, try to make the scale appropriate. That's something we could do today.
Yeah, and Rich, just quickly, what do you want us to know about what goes on behind the scenes? Because there's this image of the firefighters kind of going down the street in the truck and the kids waving to them, or they're in the firehouse and they only go out when there's a massive fire. But what are they doing behind the scenes that we don't know about that contributes to the prevention of these fires?
Well, there's really is some good news there. The fire district where I live, the private landowners, 88% of them have done what they call defensible space around their home. They've gotten out there and thinned and cut brush and done the right thing. And, of course, they got incentives to do that from a government program. but it was a program that worked really well, and we've got a lot of houses now that are secure from fire. Things like that are all over the place. There's groups forming now. There's one in Northern California, Prescribed Fire Councils, where they're helping people to learn how to do controlled burns safely and effectively. You're starting to see controlled burning used to be something that you only saw on federal public land, a little bit of state land once in a while. Now you've got private people starting to do it on a small scale because they recognize that it's effective and they recognize that it needs to be done. The fire crews, people don't realize in the winter, late fall, when it starts raining, they morph from fire crew into brush disposal crew, and they get out there and they're treating thousands of acres by thinning, they're treating acres by burning. They're getting this done, but again, the scale is very difficult. You have to ramp up, and the countervailing trend of smaller government is really putting the hurt to a lot of these good programs.
Well, we've got a couple of emails on that one, but since you brought up clearing land, let's hear from Carrie in Carson City, who's in the process of doing this. Hi, Carrie. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I want to say that a really neat program in our area is that the fire department brings trailers and dumpsters to people's property and gives us an easy way to a place to put our brush and such. And I'm in the process right now of having a crew clear some of my property. And we have a lot of brush, rabbit brush and chamois and that kind of thing. It's very burnable. And a lot of dust. And I say pull the brush first and we'll do the dust later and maybe leave some of it. My husband says, nope, take it all down to bare dirt. So I'm curious about your thoughts.
All right. Scott, do you want to take that one?
Sure. I think this idea of your shrubs and kind of the aerial feel you've talked about, maybe the chamois and the other shrubs, I think you're right. That's definitely the target for your fire hazard, the thing that's going to vector fire more quickly with flame lengths. And having a little bit of duff and litter on the floor of of your system there, you know, having that soil covered, as long as it's not right next to your house, you'd probably like to have something there, a rock or something insulated, or maybe some irrigated pasture, irrigated grass. But you can leave the duff in the wildland areas. That still will vector a fire, but it'll be a very low-intensity fire, and you probably could deal with it with your crews and your fire service. But I don't think you have to go down to bare mineral soil.
All right. Thank you for calling in, Carrie. Today we are talking about the massive wildfires that we're seeing. Scientists say that they are the new norm. Again, this is such a wild statistic. This is the seven largest fire years since 1960 have all occurred since the year 2000. And we're talking today about prevention and why this is happening, what governments should do about this, what we can do about this, with Dr. Scott Stevens, professor of fire sciences at UC Berkeley. Rich Fairbanks has worked in forestry for 41 years. He owns Fairbanks Forest Management, a company that helps property owners address these issues. And we've got about 10 minutes left. We have full lines. We'll have one open in a few minutes. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. We've got an email from Josh who says, what are the pressures from the logging industry on policy decisions? Rich, do you want to take that?
Yeah, well, it's a lot. The logging industry in Northern California and here in Oregon have a constant need for raw material. You know, they need feedstock. And in most cases, it's more expensive to buy those logs off private land. So they've been pushing the idea that that thinning is the answer, you know, for fire management problems. And I certainly agree that thinning is part of the answer. But, you know, again, they're trying, they've got their, axe to grind with respect to wanting lots of logs for their mill. Thinning works, but it's usually thinning from below, taking smaller trees. And you can imagine the profit is in larger trees. So there's sort of an ongoing tension there. But I've seen logging do a wonderful job of reducing fire hazard when it's done right, under careful supervision by people who understand fire behavior, rather than just markets. And again, that's the tension there. They want to make a profit. That's well and good, but let's do it in a way that helps the forest.
And maybe you can take his second question, Scott. He says, what chemicals are used in the aerial spraying of forest fires, and what are their impacts on forest ecology?
Well, I think this might be a better one for Rich, because okay. I'm a little out of this loop on that.
Okay, Rich?
Well, there's very little chemical use of any kind. If you mean like spraying to kill brush and stuff like that, there's very little of that on public land, federal public land. There's some of it on private land. The thing about spraying to kill brush is in the short run, after you kill the bush, it's standing there dead, and it's very flammable. It's more flammable than it was when it was alive and pumping water. So I'm not sure what the caller was asking, but chemicals have very limited use in fire management. The one exception is the aerial retardant, the red stuff that comes out of the belly of the bomber when it flies over. That has phosphorus compounds and some other compounds in it, and a lot of dye, obviously, to turn it red. And that has created problems when there's a misdrop and somebody accidentally drops the load into a stream or a lake. But other than that, there's no major use of chemicals that I know of.
So when we see aerial spraying, it's all water?
Well, you mean aerial spraying of the fire, where they're dropping on the fire?
Right.
Yes, that's a lot of that. Most of the bucket work, the helicopters, is water. That's what they do. They pick up out of a lake or a tank, and that's just regular old stream water. In fact, sometimes it's got fish in it, frogs and stuff. Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah, the bombers, the red stuff, that's water mixed with, again, phosphorus and some other compounds that coat the leaves when the retardant drop lands. It kind of coats the leaves and the trees and stuff and sort of fireproofs it for a couple hours.
All right. Well, thank you for the questions, Josh. Let's go next to Kevin calling from Felton. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I've been following this issue for many years. I live in a forest, and I also follow the affairs of the California Board of Forestry and Fire Protection, which manages logging on private land and also operates the state's obligation to control wildfire. And the point I'd like to bring up is that CDF has produced a set of recommendations for homeowners, which they have dramatically expanded in the last few years. By expanded, I mean they now recommend clearing land out to 100 feet from every house. They may allow, the recommendations allow for a few shrubs and individual trees to be left standing. But, for instance, where I live, all the houses are built within and under redwood canopy, old redwood canopy now. And if those recommendations of CDF were actually followed by the homeowners around me, it would create massive environmental damage to this place. And there's going to be pressure on these homeowners from their insurance carriers now. So I think the real solution to this in California is to be more specific about the types of forests that are involved. The flammability, as your very well-informed guests have already explained, the flammability of wild lands varies dramatically. It's hard to exaggerate the difference between, say, a coastal redwood forest's flammability and that of the Eastern Sierras. They're completely different. One would go off like a bomb within a few minutes, and another is harder, much harder to burn. So I think the state should be more reasonable and thoughtful about its recommendations, because they're going to have a lot of effect over time. And on the issue of county zoning, my county does not engage in requirements for houses in areas where people are building in chaparral. They don't require steel roofs, which is a major improvement. They don't require stucco exterior walls. So that's another issue which I agree with your guess, which would have a hugely positive effect and is not being acted upon. And he's right. Every county can do this independently.
All right. Well, thank you, Kevin, calling from Felton. We have another caller on home issues. So let's hear from Richard in Big Sur, and then we'll get responses. Hi, Richard. Welcome to the show. Hi,
I'm
Richard.
I'm out here in the fringes, and I was here on the ground in the Basin Complex fire 5 years back. I had designed and built a home, a pole foundation home, that walked through the fire unescorted. All the other homes in the neighborhood burned to the ground. It's not that hard. It's really not that hard. Your last caller touched on it briefly. A little bit of sensible design, it's not that hard. You don't need to nuke it down to the ground, just a little bit of sensible management. And sensible management also means step on up, be proactive. Maybe burn in April or May when it will just barely. All the firefighters, they're sitting on their hands right then anyway.
All right, well, thank you for calling in. Rich, what are your thoughts on Kevin and Richard's comments about homes?
Well, I think they're both correct. The lack of county supervision of what kind of materials go into houses and stuff like that, the lack of input from the science community and the people who are going to pay for these fires, the public, is a problem. And the earlier caller sounded like he'd had some trouble dealing with the government there, Cal Fire. And all I can say there is keep trying. You know, it's a big, huge bureaucracy, and it takes time to get through to people. But they'll do the right thing if you push it hard enough. And just in general, the zoning and building codes really are a basic part of the solution to the wildfire problem in the western U.S. I'm real firm about that. And then, as we said, control burning under very carefully controlled circumstances with skilled professionals is kind of the third part of that that solution.
All right. Well, thank you for those calls. And maybe we can find some good resources on home building for people who are interested in that, and we'll put it on our website after the show. We've got time for a few more callers. Let's hear from Katie in Oakland. Hi, Katie.
Hi. Thank you for having me on. I know that climate change is something that's come up as a cause of the forest fires and the death of trees or the endangering of trees, and people have asked, well, what can we do? Well, I wanted to let you know that on Saturday, there's going to be a very large march, rally, and nonviolent direct action at the gates of Chevron, starting at the BART station in Richmond at 10 o'clock. Bill McKibben will be there to speak. The mayor of Richmond will lead the march. We're going to have a children's brigade. It's going to be wonderful, and we're expecting in the low thousands of people. So I just want to let people know you can do something about climate change. Come on Saturday to Richmond.
All right. Well, thank you for that, Katie. And we'll put some information on that action on our website at Chevron to mark, I believe it's been a year, right, since the explosion in Richmond. We should do a follow-up show about that. So thank you so much for calling in, Katie. We've got an email from Don who says, my impression is that forest fires, large ones, usually occur on government-owned forests and not privately owned forests. Is this so? And if so, why does this happen?
Hey, can I take that one, Scott?
Sure.
Yeah, the numbers that I've got from Morrison's paper is 70% of the acres burned in the United States is private. So, no, I'm afraid the numbers contradict that statement. 70% private is what burns.
Okay.
And of course, that's where the houses are, too, obviously. There's no housing on federal property.
Right. And so, again, this goes back to code restrictions, zoning, building rules,
yeah.
Right?
Yep, exactly. And I think the fires on public land tend to get a lot more press. They're big, giant waves of flame and so forth. You know, it's dramatic and stuff like that. But when you look at the hard numbers, it's 70% private land is what burns.
Okay. All right. Thanks for the email, Don. Is there anything else you want to add about why this is happening? I mean, we're getting dry, very dry seasons, climate change. And then NPR had an interesting piece last August called How the Smoky Bear Effect Led to Raging Wildfires. Can you talk about that, Scott?
Sure. You know, the Smoky Bear came in right around World War II, and it's been classified as one of the most successful public education campaigns in the history of the United States. And I think Smokey Bear's message of being careful with wildfires still resonates with all of us today. But it also sometimes feels like it gets into the notion that all fire is bad. And Rich alludes to this idea of prescribed burning, getting more fire on the ground for kind of an objective, ecological, and also fire hazard reduction. So, yeah, when you have that icon that's actually ingrained, Smokey still has a zip code, post office, you can write to him, get a letter back. So it's still a big piece of our lexicon. But But all fire is not bad, and fire is actually marvelous in terms of ecosystems if used properly. And in fact, it's needed, as Rich has alluded to. Without it, we're really going to be further in a hole. Mm-hmm. So it's that nuanced message that, yes, we want to be careful with all fire, and people start a lot of fires accidentally, but by no means is fire bad ecologically in most systems if they're used appropriately.
So write to Smokey the Bear. Don't email him. Write to him to save the post office. So you're doing two things at once. Rich, Scott brings up such a good point about our relationship with fire. And just, it seems people think of it as such a bad thing. Can you talk about that just quickly?
Well, there's an expression that we use, that fire is a good servant, but a very poor master. And if we can recognize that it's a process that's millions of years old and has been shaping the forests of the West for millions of years, and if we just respect that and learn to work with that, that fire is here, it's part of the system, then it does not become our master. And when we sit around and wait for lightning strikes and then call out a bunch of crews and put a bunch of young kids in the way of that fire, well, that's one way to do it. But I think what Scott and I are getting at is, gee, if we burned in the winter and we kind of respected what this system's been doing for a few million years, we'd probably be a lot better off.
And do you think it'd be good to bring that number from 450 back to 800?
Well, yes, I'm very, very concerned about the way they've been cutting resources, because if I've spent a lot of time on the fire line, and if you don't have the stuff, if you don't have a crew next to you, if you're not covered, mm-hmm. you don't have enough people, it creates a hazard in itself.
Yeah.
You need to fully staff these fires.
Rich Fairbanks has worked in forestry for 41 years, and Dr. Scott Stevens is professor of fire sciences at UC Berkeley. Thank you both so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thank you, and thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss media coverage of the Bradley Manning trial. How are reporters covering what the documents he leaked actually contain? He says he leaked them to start a debate about U.S. foreign policy. So where's the debate? And what are the consequences of this case for the future of journalism? Join the conversation and call in with your questions on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.